In case you were wondering what that terrible music was, since this program is going to be recorded and broadcast on Halloween, I figured it'd be nice to start off with a little bit of scary music. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports, and occasionally a spooky something or other. Okay, let's start off with a little bit of Halloween humor. One witch told another witch, "I want one of those new computers that has a spell checker." "Don't bother inviting the invisible man to your Halloween party. He won't show up." "Sometimes he makes excuses, but they're all transparent." "You don't have to worry about daylight savings time at Halloween. The holiday was always on the Greenwich meantime. Western Union opened an office in a graveyard so the spoofs could send and receive cryptograms. Vampire pickup line. "What's your type?" A vampire joined the police force so he could learn the correct way to get a stakeout. Halloween groaner. A man was walking home alone one night when he heard a bump, bump, bump behind him. Walking faster, he looked back, making out an image of an upright coffin banging its way down the middle of the street towards him. Bump, bump, bump. The man began to run faster towards his home. The coffin bounced after him faster and faster. Bump, 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 bump. He ran up to his door, fumbled with his keys, opened the door, rushed in, and locked it behind him. The coffin crashed through his door with the lid of the coffin clapping, bump, 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 on the heels of the terrified man. The man rushed upstairs to the bathroom and locked himself in, heart pounding. With a crash, the coffin broke down the door, coming slowly toward him. The man, while screaming, reached for something, anything. All he could find was a box of cough drops, which he hurled at the coffin, and suddenly, the coffin stops. And after that horrible introduction, we'll go ahead and move on to the Reader's Digest, like we're supposed to anyway. But I felt like I needed to instill a little bit of extra into the show this week. Okay, we're still doing the nicest places in America. We didn't quite finish them last week. Unity Park in Greenville, South Carolina. 82 years we waited for the park, said City Councilman Lillian Brock Fleming. The little children don't know the history, but they'll get a good time when they get there. Opened in 2022, Unity Park is a 60-acre, $60 million marvel of modern landscape architecture on the southern side neighborhood of Greenville, South Carolina. The city at the foot of the Blue Ridge Mountains and cleft by the Reedy River has equipped the park with every bell, whistle, and imagine for its 72,000 residents. And it's a beautiful picture of the park. It's gorgeous. But the true transformation isn't one of Greenville's facilities. It's for Greenville's spirit. Unity Park now stands where two formerly segregated parks, Maryberry Park and Meadowbrook Park, stood on for nearly a century. Back in 1927, Maryberry Park was the only place in Greenville where black children could play. "It was all we had," says Mary Duckett, president of the Southern Side Neighborhoods in Action. But the city treated the park as its spare room. Greenville took a portion for a police shooting range. Kids knew to steer clear during Saturday target practice. And then some more for public works facility, which housed a landfill, trash incinerators, and a parking lot for garbage trucks. "I've heard people describe it as the community junkyard," says Greenville, Housing Fund President Brian Brown. In 1938, the city took half of Maryberry Park to build Meadowbrook Park, a minor league baseball stadium. Maryberry Park was reduced to a sandlot, living in the literal shadow of its neighborhood prize column, Coliseum, one that explicitly barred the black residents who had frequented the park for over a decade. In 1939, when South Carolina was in the clutches of Jim Crow, a man named E.B. Holloway, who was Greenville's first black mail carrier, petitioned the city council for a true city park for the black community. "We want the park because we need it," Holloway wrote to the Greenville Piedmont newspaper. "We want the park because our social and recreational life is at stake. Give us a park." The city council agreed to build a real park and did nothing for nearly a century. So the Unity Park that visitors enjoy today makes good on a promise long forsaken. Fittingly, all who entered are greeted by Holloway himself, along with his wife, Hattie Jordan Holloway. The pair are pictured on a mural under the words, "A Promise Fulfilled." Many of the Holloway's resident descendants attended Unity Park's grand opening. With its massive green spaces and restored wetlands, as well as walking and biking trails, covered picnic areas, state-of-the-art playgrounds, splash pads, basketball courts, baseball fields, and even outdoor classrooms. Unity Park is a utopia of fellowship and leisure far beyond anything Holloway could have dreamed. But Greenville is aware that the park will invite gentrification and displacement of longtime Southernsiders. When you create a new community asset, it always generates investment interest and makes the surrounding area very attractive to people who haven't lived there before, says Brown. Aiming to fulfill Unity Park's namesake promise, the city has donated 8 acres of land around the park for affordable housing. Workers have broken ground on 4 developments so far. You can never catch up, says Councilwoman Fleming, but it's a start. Look at the word unity. It's the last part of the word community, she says. Southernside has always been the type of community that invited folks in. Mark Barbecue, or Mark BBQ, however you want to say it, in Colchester, Vermont. When Daryl Langworthy was growing up, Thanksgiving meant 30 neighbors sharing a potluck meal in the family driveway. My parents worked at a golf course. They'd invite all the workers to Thanksgiving dinner. They would never turn anybody away, he says. If there was a kid in the neighborhood who needed dinner, he got it. Today, Langworthy carries a tradition at his restaurants in Colchester, Vermont, where a combination of barbecue and community service has made Mark BBQ a hot spot. Colchester is a small town on the shores of Lake Champlain, just north of Burlington. Locals know Mark BBQ for its brisket burgers, pulled pork sandwiches, and Tex-Mex meatloaf. For many, Mark BBQ is also a stop on the road to recovery. Enter Recovery Kitchen, a program that brings former addicts into the kitchen to build service and industry skills. The effort was inspired by manager Casey DeGuise, who arrived with a troubled history and even more determination. He had been turned down for 35 jobs, Langworthy says. We said, let's take a chance, and he's never, never let me down. Langworthy knows that a little help can go a long way. I had a time when I was definitely drinking too much, he recalls. Now he offers to others the support he once needed. He keeps a cooler by Mark's BBQ front door with free food for anyone who wants it. But his favorite pastime is still watching full plates turn into dirty dishes. If we can pay the bills and staff, we're happy, says Langworthy. If we can help the community, we're even happier. Our finalists. For the past 7 years, our readers have nominated thousands of towns, cities, libraries, parks, and even Front Porch as some of the nicest places in America. Take a journey around the country to see this year's winners. And start on the map above. Read more and visit our previous nicest places at rd.com/nicest, where we were already collecting nominations for 2024. And the one they ran through this term account is Buffalo, New York, Whatcher Flower Farm in Providence, Rhode Island, Red Lodge, Montana, Unity Park in Greenville, South Carolina, and Mark BBQ in Chulster, Vermont. Our past winner was Gatlin, Tennessee in 2017, Yasin Falafel House in Knoxville, Tennessee in 2018, Columbiana, Ohio in 2019, Buchanan, Michigan in 2020, The Quality Inn in Kodak, Tennessee, and Coulterville, California in 2022. The road to the nicest places. When it comes to choosing the nicest places in America, Reader's Digest has always had an infallible North Star, our readers. Every year we ask you to nominate the nicest places you know, and every year your submission blows us away. Choosing our finalists means making some tough decisions, and our hats off to all of you good people out there spreading kindness. After a thorough vetting process, our editors and judges named 2023's nicest place in America. Mitch Albin, philanthropist and author of Tuesday with Maury, Monica Guzman, senior fellow for public practice at Bravery Angels and author of I Never Thought of It That Way, Bonnie Kinser, chief executive officer of Trusted Media Brands, Jim Rhodes, nominator of Coulterville, California, 2022's nicest place in America, and Deneen Tor, Dollar General's vice president of corporate social responsibility and philanthropy. Now here is a very current subject, national interest. AI means never having to say goodbye. New technology lets us talk to the dead people. But is that really a good idea? My parents don't know that I spoke to them last night. At first they sounded distant and tinny as if they were huddled around a phone in a prison cell. But as we chatted, they slowly started to sound more like themselves. They told me personal stories I'd never heard. I learned about the first time my dad got drunk. Mom talked about getting in trouble for staying out late. They gave me life advice and told me things about their childhood as well as my own. It was mesmerizing. "What's the worst thing about you?" I asked Dad, since he was clearly in such a candid mood. "My worst quality is that I'm a perfectionist. I can't stand messiness and untidiness, and that always presents a challenge, especially being nearer to Jane." Then he laughed, and for a moment I forgot I wasn't really speaking to my parents at all, but through their digital replicas. This mom and dad live inside an app on my phone, as voice assistants constructed by the California-based company Hereafter AI. The company's goal is to let the living communicate with the dead. I wanted to test out what it might be like. Technology like this will let you talk with people who have died has been a mainstay of science fiction for decades, but now it's become a reality and an increasingly accessible one thanks to advances in AI and voice technology. My real flesh and blood parents are still alive and well and living in London. Their virtual versions were made just to help me understand the technology. But their avatars offer a glimpse at a world where it's possible to converse, so to speak, with loved ones long after they're gone. That's kind of scary. From what I could glean over a dozen conversations with my virtually deceased parents, this really will make it easier to feel close to the people we've loved and lost. It's not hard to see the appeal. People might turn to digital replicas for comfort or to mark special milestones like anniversaries. But for some, this tech may be alarming or downright creepy. When I talked to friends about this article, some of them physically recoiled. There's a common, deeply held belief that we mess with death at our peril. But I'm only human, and that worry ends up being washed away by the even scarier prospect of losing the people I love. If technology might help me hang on to them, is it so wrong to try? Chatbots and voice assistants, such as Siri and Alexa, have gone from high-tech knowledge to part of daily life for millions of people over the past decade. We've become very comfortable with the idea of talking to our devices about everything from the weather forecast to the meaning of life. Now, AI large language models, LLMs, which can ingest a few prompt sentences and spit out convincing text in response, promise to unlock even more powerful ways for humans to communicate with machines. What's more, it's possible to tweak LLM software like OpenAI's GPT-3 or Google's Llama to make it sound more like a specific person by feeding it lots of things that the person said. At the same time, AI has progressed in its ability to mimic specific physical voices, a practice called voice cloning. It also has been getting better at injecting digital personalities, whether cloned from a real person or completely artificial, with more of the qualities that make a voice sound human. At the end of 2019, I saw that James Vlahos, the co-founder of Hereafter AI, will be speaking at an online conference about virtual beings. His company is one of the handful of startups working in the field dubbed Grief Tech. They differ in their approaches but share the same promise to enable you to talk by video, chat, text, phone, or voice assistant with a digital version of someone who is no longer alive. Intrigued by what Vlahos was promising, I rang an introduction and persuaded him and his colleagues to let me experiment with their software on my very much alive parents. Initially, I thought it would be just a fun project to see what was technologically possible. Then the pandemic added some urgency to the proceedings. I worried about my parents. I was terrified that they might die, and with the strict restrictions on hospital visits at the time, I might never have a chance to say goodbye. The first step was an interview. To create a digital replica of someone with a good chance of seeming like a convincingly authentic representation, you need data, and lots of it. Hereafter starts with the subjects when they are still alive, asking them questions for hours about everything from their earliest memories to their first date to what they believe will happen after they die. My parents were interviewed by a real live human, but in another sign of just how quickly technology is progressing, interviews are now typically automated and handled by a bot. Whether through pandemic-induced malaise or a weary willingness to humor their daughter, my parents put up zero resistance. The company then took their responses and started to create the voice assistants. A couple of months later, a note popped into my inbox. My virtual parents were ready. This mom and dad arrived via email attachment. I could communicate with them through Alexa app on a phone or an Amazon Echo device. When I opened the file, my hands were shaking. I hadn't seen my actual real parents for 6 months. "Alexa, open Hereafter," I directed. "Would you rather speak with Paul or with Jane?" a voice asked. After a bit of quick mental deliberation, I opted for my mum. The voice that was hers, but weirdly stiff and cold, spoke. "Hello, this is Jane G., and I'm happy to tell you about my life. How are you today?" I laughed nervously. I'm well, thanks, Mom. How are you? Long pause. Good. At my end, I'm doing well. You sound kind of unnatural, I said. She ignored me and carried on speaking. Before we start, here are a few pointers. My listening skills aren't the best, unfortunately, so you may have to wait until I have finished talking and ask you a question before you say something back. When it's your turn to speak, please keep your answers fairly short. A few words, a simple sentence, that type of thing, she explained. After a bit more introduction, she said, okay, let's get started. There's so much to talk about. My childhood, my career, my interests, which of those sounds best? Scripted bits like this sounded stilted and strange, but as we moved on with my mother recounting memories and speaking in her own words, she sounded far more relaxed and natural. Still, this conversation and the ones that followed were limited. When I tried asking my mom's bot about her favorite jewelry, for instance, I got, sorry, I didn't understand that. You can try asking another way or move on to another topic. There were also mistakes that were jarring to the point of hilarity. One day, Dad's bot asked me how I was. I replied, I'm feeling sad today. He responded with a cheery, good. The overall experience was undeniably weird. Every time I spoke to their virtual versions, it struck me that I could have been talking to my real parents instead. On one occasion, my husband even mistook my testing out the bots for an actual phone call. In early 2022, I got a demo of a similar technology from a company called Storyfile, which launched in 2017 and promises to make things to the next level. Its life service records responses on video rather than voice alone. Storyfile CEO Stephen Smith demonstrated technology on a video call where we were joined by his mother. She died earlier that year, but here she was on the call, sitting in a comfortable chair in a living room. She was soft-spoken with wispy hair and friendly eyes. She dispensed life advice. She seemed wise. Smith told me that his mother attended her own funeral. At the end, she said, I guess that's it for me. Goodbye. And everyone burst into tears. He told me her digital participation was well received by family and friends. And arguably, most important of all, Smith said he's deeply comforted by the fact that he managed to capture his mother on camera before she passed away. The video technology itself looked relatively slick and professional, though the results still felt vaguely within the uncanny valley, especially in the facial expressions. At points, much as with my own parents, I had to remind myself that she wasn't really there. Both Hereafter and Storyfile aim to preserve someone's life story rather than allowing you to have a full, new conversation each time. This is one of the major limitations of many current offerings in grief tech. They're generic. These replicas may sound like someone you love, but they know nothing about you. Anyone can talk to them, and they'll reply in the same tone, and the replies to a given question are the same every time you ask. The biggest issue with technology is the idea that you can generate a single universal person, says Justin Harrison, founder of a service called You, Only Virtual. But the way we experience people is unique to us. You, Only Virtual, and a few other services want to go further, arguing that recounting memories won't capture the fundamental essence of a relationship between two people. Harrison says he wants to create a personalized bot that's for you and you alone by uploading someone's text messages, emails, and voice conversations. That is exactly what he's done with his mother, Baloti, who has stage 4 cancer. I built it by hand using 5 years of my messages with her, he says in his chatbot. Harrison says the interaction he has with the bot are more meaningful to him than if they were simply regurgitating memories. BotBomb uses the phrases she'd use and replies to him in the way she'd reply, calling him honey and using the emojis she'd use and the same spelling quirks. He won't be able to ask his mother avatar questions about her life, but that doesn't bother him. The point for him is to capture the way someone communicates. Just recounting memories has little to do with the essence of a relationship, he says. Some people find that hearing voices of their loved ones after they're gone helps with the grieving process. It's not uncommon for people to listen to voicemails from someone who has died, for example, says Aaron Thompson, a clinical psychologist who specializes in grief. Creating a virtual avatar that you can have more of a conversation with could be a valuable, healthy way to feel connected to someone you loved and lost, he says. But a grieving person needs to know that these bots can only ever capture a small sliver of someone. They are not sentient, and they will not replace healthy, functional human relationships. Particularly in the first weeks and months after a loved one dies, people struggle to accept the loss and may find any reminder of the person triggering. In the acute phase of grief, you can get a strong sense of unreality, not being able to accept they're gone. Thompson says, arguably, the risk might be small today given these technologies' flaws, even though sometimes I fell for the illusion it was clear my parents' bots were not, in fact, the real deal. And there are other risks. Any service that allows you to create a digital replica of someone without a person's participation raises complex ethical issues regarding consent and privacy. While some might argue that permission is less important with someone who is no longer alive, can't you also argue that the person who generated the other side of the conversation should have a say too? And what if that person is not, in fact, dead? There's little to stop people from using grief tech to create virtual versions of living people without their consent. For example, an ex. Companies that sell services powered by text messages are aware of this possibility and say they will delete a person's data if that individual requests it. But companies are not obligated to do any checks to make sure their technology is being limited to people who have consented or died. If digital replicas become mainstream, there will inevitably need to be new processes and norms around the legacies they leave behind. And if we learn anything from the history of technological development, we'll be better off if we grapple with the possibility of those replicas misused before, not after, they reach mass adoption. Price could be another drawback. Although so many of these services have a free version, the cost can easily run into the hundreds, even thousands of dollars. Then there's the time involved. Creating an avatar or chatbot of someone requires time and effort, not the least of which is just building up the energy and motivation to get started. This is true both for the user and for the subject, who may be nearing death and whose active participation may be required. Fundamentally, people don't like grappling with the fact that they're going to die, says marketer Sache, who launched a digital avatar company called Eternamime in 2014, which then shuttered in 2018 after it failed to pick up enough users. It's something you can put off until next week, next month, next year, he says. People assume that AI is the key to breaking this, but really, it's human behavior. Ersatz's parents never managed to get around to recording memories for him. My dad passed away last year, and I never did those recordings, and now I feel like an idiot, he says. Personally, I have mixed feelings about my experiment. I'm glad to have had the virtual audio versions of my parents, even if they're imperfect. They've enabled me to learn new things about my parents, and it's comforting to think that those bots will be there even when my parents aren't. I'm already thinking about who else I might want to capture digitally, my husband, my sisters, maybe some of my friends. On the other hand, like a lot of people, I don't want to think about the people I love dying. It's uncomfortable, and I can't help but find it sad that it took a stranger Zoom interviewing my parents for me to properly appreciate the multifaceted, complex people they are. But I feel lucky to have had the chance to grasp that and to still have the precious opportunity to spend more time with them and learn more about them face-to-face, no technology involved. 7 Ways You Can Use AI. Remember Rosie the Robot from the Jetsons or Robot B9 from Lost in Space? How great would it be to have robot assistants like the ones from our favorite cartoons and sci-fi shows? Well, AI chatbots like ChatGPT are getting us there. They offer everyday uses for just about everyone. Here are a few. Manage your inbox. AI can sort through your mails in a flash, identify important messages, and even compose responses on your behalf. You can check in before they're sent if you'd like. Number 2, plan a trip. Try a pop-lock. I have 36 hours in Atlanta. Can you suggest a travel itinerary that includes must-try restaurants and music venues? Number 3, give or get homework help. Socratic is an AI app that helps students with math problems and other homework. It won't do their homework for them, but it can explain concepts and walk them through a math solution. Number 4, plan meals. You could say, give me 10 ideas for dinners that aren't burgers. Or if you have limited ingredients in your fridge, you could ask for 5 meal ideas that use carrots and onions. Number 5, learn English. The AI app Elsa can teach English to those who speak other languages. Simply talk to it in English, and it will correct your pronunciation and give you tips on how to speak more fluently. Number 6, take notes. Fireflies is an AI app that takes notes and transcribes them for you. Handy for difficult conversations or ones that require your full attention, when you're talking with a doctor, say, or discussing loved ones' last wishes. You can use it in person, over the phone, or via video, and when the app is done with its job, you can share the notes with others. And number 7, get design ideas. Is your home ready for a refresh? Try something like, "You are an interior designer. Please provide me with 10 ideas for my bathroom that make use of natural wood." The more details you provide, the better the results will be. How about another scary Halloween story? This short tale starts benignly enough with a friendly-seeming ghost playing with children. But when you learn the origin of the ghost and just why the ghost is moving the object around the room, it quickly gets a lot creepier. When my sister Betsy and I were kids, our family lived for a while in a charming old farmhouse. We loved exploring its dusty corners and climbing the apple tree in the backyard. But our favorite thing was the ghost. We called her Mother because she seemed so kind and nurturing. Some mornings, Betsy and I would wake up, and on each of our nightstands, we'd find a cup that hadn't been there the night before. Mother had left them there, worried that we'd get thirsty during the night. She just wanted us to take care of us. Among the home's original furnishing was an antique wooden chair, which it kept against the back wall of the living room. Whenever we were preoccupied watching TV or playing a game, Mother would inch that chair forward across the room toward us. Sometimes she'd manage to move it all the way to the center of the room. We always felt sad putting it back against the wall. Mother just wanted to be near us. Years later, long after we'd moved out, I found an old newspaper article about the farmhouse's original occupant, a widow. She'd murdered her 2 children by giving them each a cup of poisoned milk before bed. Then she hung herself. The article included a photo of the farmhouse living room, with a woman's body hanging from a beam. Beneath her, knocked over, was that old wooden chair, placed exactly in the center of the room. Is it colder in here, or is it just me? Now on to something a little less weird. Great glasses for way less from Consumer Reports. Should you buy inexpensive eyeglasses online or get your frames in person? Where to find the best deal, service, and quality at the lowest possible price? And this is good to me because I need a new pair of glasses. These days, buying glasses can be complicated, especially if you're looking for options beyond those your eye doctor sells. You can instead take a copy of a prescription, you're legally entitled to it, to a locally optical shop, a chain such as LensCrafter or a big box store like Target, or an online site search such as Werber, Warby Parker, or Zenni Optical. Wherever you go, you'll have to choose the size, style, and make of the frames. That's before you even get to the lenses. There are a lot of different options, and I think sometimes peaches can feel overwhelmed, says Frank Abui, OD, assistant clinical professor at the State University of Newark College of Optometry in New York City. It can sometimes feel like you're going into a car dealership. Costs can vary wildly from place to place. In a 2022 survey of 11,450 Consumer Reports members who purchased new glasses in the previous 2 years, people paid a medium of $205 after insurance, or $224 out of pocket. But the median price at independent optical shops was $346 after insurance, or $511 out of pocket. Members who shopped at 2 to 4 top-rated stores, Costco and Warby Parker, paid a medium of $160 and $190 after insurance, respectively. To help you get the right glasses at the lower price, we use member surveys to rate satisfaction with 16 retailers, as well as private eye doctors' offices and independent shops. We also ask a variety of experts about the best way to buy new glasses and how to avoid potential bedfalls. And there's a whole page with a picture of different glasses, all different styles. Getting the most from buying in person. Most of CR's members, about 90%, opted to buy glasses in person rather than online. The most common reason members gave for choosing a retailer, it's a place where they had their eye exam. There are plenty of advantages to getting your glasses from a physical store. A major one, according to Micah Moy, OD, a clinical professor at the Herbert Wertheim School of Optometry and Vision Science at UC Berkeley in California, is the ability to try on the glasses and have an expert tell you, based on your prescription, the pros and cons of those glasses in your face. If you have a strong prescription, it may require thicker lenses, for example. Some very large frames might not be ideal because big, thick lenses may make your glasses feel too heavy. In person, opticians who have expert in fitting glasses can also perform specific measurements to get you a better fit. A variety of facial measurements helps opticians make sure that when we insert the lenses into the frame, the lenses are aligned appropriately with the patient's pupils, says Molly Drennan, a licensed optician and program manager for the Optical Technology Program at Cuyahoga Community College in Ohio. And once your glasses are made, opticians can also help you adjust them to ensure that they're properly aligned and feel comfortable on your face. In-person shoppers have a variety of options. There are some pros and cons that members identified in our survey. Private doctor's office, pros: classes, quality, consumer service, fitting, and follow-up service. Store policy, store atmospheres, and the cons of the price. Median price after insurance was $262. Independent glass stores, pros: glasses quality, customer service fitting, follow-up service, store policies, and store atmosphere. The cons are the price. Median price after insurance was $346. Warehouse clubs. Pros are customer service, fitting, follow-up, store policies, and with one exception, BJ's price. Median price based after insurance from $168 Costco to $203 to Sam's Club. I wonder why BJ's was off. Superstores, customer service, fitting, follow-up, and at Target, frame quality and store policies. No major cons. Rated categories all received at least a middling score. The median price paid after insurance for $169 at Walmart to $195 at Target. Chain glasses stores, pros: plenty of locations, in some cases good customer service. Cons: price, with one exception that rated well for price, and that was Warby Parker. Median price paid after insurance from $190 at Warby Parker includes an in-person sales to $326 for lens crafters. Should you try an online eye exam? Some online retailers offer tests as well as eyeglasses. Can you trust the results? A Warby Parker rep told us that the company app-based version test the exam and eye doctor usually performs in person to determine your prescription uses your phone camera, sensors, and logarithms to make sure you're positioned the correct distance from the device for accurate results. But this test can be used only to renew an existing prescription with no changes. It won't generate a new prescription. Several experts expressed concern about such tests, mainly because they are too narrow in scope. UC Berkeley MECMAOD says the test can't evaluate the visual comfort of a prescription. They also leave out the critical health assessment that's part of a comprehensive eye exam, which includes checks for cataract, glaucoma, macular degeneration, and more. So even if you use an online prescription renewal service in a pinch, it's important to have an in-person eye exam every year or two, depending on your age and health status. The pros and cons of purchasing online. For some people, shopping for eyeglasses online may offer a few distinct advantages. CR members who use online stores reported convenience as an important reason for going that route. And then there's cost, which is probably a key draw for online shoppers. In our ratings, prominent online retailers such as iBuyDirect, Warby Parker, and Zenni Optical received high marks from our members when it came to price. At Zenni Optical, members reported paying a median of just $87 after insurance. In addition, research suggests that the quality of glasses from online retailers has markedly improved. In one 2021 study, just 10% of glasses ordered online failed to meet industry standards for factors like prescription quality and impact resistance. A similar study from 2011 found that rate to be about 45%. Little data is available on how often glasses from physical stores need to be remade, but few experts said optometrists can switch lens labs if they notice frequent mistakes. Still, online shopping has plenty of drawbacks. One measure is that you won't have an in-person optician measuring and checking to make sure the glasses you want will be a good fit for your face and your prescription. That's probably fine for consumers who need single-vision lenses with milder lenses of correction, according to a number of experts we spoke with. But the stronger and more complicated your prescription, if you need multifocal or progressive lenses, or astigmatism correction, for example, the more you lean to buying in person. Classifications vary, but the American Academy of Ophthalmology considers severe nearsightedness to be a prescription of minus 6 or worse, and severe farsightedness to be a prescription of 5.5 or higher. That's in part because stronger your prescription, the more precisely your glasses need to be aligned with your pupils, says Neil Pincer, OD, Associate Dean for Clinical and Patient Care Services at Indiana University School of Optometry in Bloomington. Misalignment can lead to headaches and other issues. Progressive lenses, in particular, are generally more complicated and require more care and expertise in fitting. This is Adam Gordon, OD, a professor at the School of Optometry at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. In CR survey, members who order progressive lenses from online sellers did not rate the quality of their glasses significantly lower than those who purchased other types of lenses online. Still, if your vision needs are more complex, use caution if you opt to shop online. All online shoppers should pay close attention to return policies, says Moore at UC Berkeley. Be sure you can get your money back if the glasses aren't working for you. If after a week your glasses are still uncomfortable, you should probably return them. Pick the right features for you. Whenever you opt to shop, you'll need to make several decisions. After you settle on the frames you want, the next step is lens material. Here are some options. CR39. Apart from glass, which is no longer widely used, this is the most basic of lens materials. It is sometimes referred to as standard plastic. CR39 lenses are inexpensive, and they are not as light and durable as pricier options. People with stronger prescriptions, which require thicker, heavier lenses, may find that glasses made of this material slide down their nose or from heaven on your face. Polycarbonate or Trivex. Most lenses sold in the U.S. these days are made from a type of plastic called polycarbonate, says Michael Vitale, Vice President of Membership, Government Relations, and Technical Standards for the Vision Council, an industry group. Polycarbonate is more lightweight and impact-resistant than CR39, but it does scratch easily, which is why most polycarbonate lenses come with scratch-resistant coating. Trivex, a newer plastic lens material, offers similar advantages to polycarbonate, but also requires a scratch-resistant coating. It may result in slightly better image clarity than polycarbonate, but tends to be more expensive. High index. High index lenses are generally thinner and lighter than polycarbonate lenses. These can be a good choice if you have a strong prescription, particularly if you prefer a larger frame, because the lenses won't be noticeably thick at the edges. High index numbers from 1.6 to 1.7. The higher the number, the thinner the lens. The pricier, too. Once you've picked a lens type, you'll need to choose which of the available coatings you want. Some options are useful and others are less so. Scratch resistant. This helps to enhance the durability of the more scratch-prone types of lenses and is standard on glasses from a variety of retailers, including Costco Optical, Warby Parker, and Zenni Optical. Estimated cost is $16 to $40. Anti-reflective, AR. The key advantage is that lenses with anti-reflective treatment allow more light to reach your eyes, according to Drennan at the Optical Technology Program at Cuyahoga Community College. That's especially beneficial for older people whose eyes naturally let in less light, and for driving at night when the light is already low. The stronger your prescription, the more important this feature, because stronger prescriptions tend to reflect more light, Drennan says. One downside, says according to Dasha Hirsch, MD, the clinical spokesman at the American Academy of Ophthalmology, is that this coating can wear off over time, which can lead to your glasses seeming permanently smudged. But most AR coatings should last for the lifetime of the prescription. Most prescriptions are valid for 1 or 2 years, Vitale says. Proper lens care will also help with longevity, so use lens cleaner and lens cloth to wipe your lenses off rather than a t-shirt or a paper towel. While basic AR coating is becoming standard on many lenses, premium anti-reflecting coatings are also available. Several experts tell us that these are likely to be more durable. Premium AR coatings also tend to include additional features such as smudge resistance and anti-fog coating. The estimated cost for these is $75 to $150. UV protection. These days, a coating that protects your eyes from ultraviolet light is included with many lenses, but it's a must-add if the glasses you're buying don't have this. You can't put sunscreen on the surface of the eye or on your eyelids, Hirsch says, and it's possible to get skin cancer in those areas. UV light can also contribute to development of cataracts. Estimated cost is $10 to $25. Blue light blocking. A popular add-on for glasses these days, this coating, which is sometimes yellow-tinted, is meant to filter out blue-colored light. It's touted to reduce eye strain from all-day computer use, enhance sleep, and even improve eye health. Some evidence suggests that blocking blue light might indeed be useful for improving sleep, because blue light affects the circadian rhythms that govern sleep. But there's insufficient evidence that this can ease eye strain or reduce the risk of eye diseases such as macular degeneration. And though adding blue blocking to your glasses isn't harmful, Berkeley's Moist says there are other cheaper ways of achieving the same effect. For instance, you could choose the night mode on electronic devices, which filters out blue light at the source. The estimated costs are not available because this coating isn't associated with a specific medical code. The other numbers that matter. Pupillary distance is the distance between the centers of your pupils, which tells lens makers that the horizontal center of the lens should be in your eyeglasses. If you're shopping in person, an optician typically measures this, but if you're shopping online, ask your eye doctor for it. It's not generally required on prescriptions. An optician at an optical shop may also measure it for a fee. If you had your PD measured once as an adult, you generally don't need to do it again. And he's quoting how shopping around got me a better deal. Last fall, I updated my prescription and bought a new pair of glasses. But lately, I've been feeling like it's time for more adventurous specs. I wanted brightly colored frames, polycarbonate or high-index lenses, and anti-reflective, ultraviolet protection, and scratch-resistant coatings. I started at my local eyewear shop and found a pair of purple frames I love. But with my lenses, they've had cost $400. Here's what I found when I shopped around online. Zini Optical, $33. These coral frames cost just $7. The 1.61 index lenses added $21 to my tab, and AR was $5, UFI and SR were included. I buy direct, $72. These grape-colored frames cost $39. I also price 1.6 index lenses, $28, and UV protection, $5. SR and AR treatments were included. Costco Optical. These Lillian frames were $60, and 1.6 index lenses with UV, SR, and AR cost $60. I'm not a Costco member, so I'd also spend $60 to join. $193 for GlassesUSA.com. For the Tory Burch frames, the price was $105. UV protection, SR, and AR came with the $88 platinum package. 1.61 index lenses. Target Optical. With these 140 Ralph Lauren frames, the only 1.67 index lenses offered for my RX cost of $290. AR, SR, and UV coatings were included. And a look at what the members told us about their experiences shopping for glasses and how satisfied they were with everything from frame selection to price. The overall satisfaction score. Costco Optical got an 80. Warburg Parker got a 74. Sam's Club Optical got a 73. Independent Glasses Shop got a 72. Private Doctor's Office got a 70. Target Optical got a 68. Kaiser Permanente, 67. iBuy Direct, 65. Glasses USA, 62. Walmart Vision Chaser, 62. Zini Optical only got a 59. Pearl Vision, 57. iMart Express, 56. BJ's Optical got a 55. Mr. Eye Doctor got a 55. Lens Crafters got a 54. That's terrible. VisionWorks got a 51. And America's Best Contacts and Eyeglasses only got a 45. With the holiday season coming up not too distantly, CR's Guide to Hassle-Free Flying is probably a pretty current article. How to pay less, wait less, and mostly stress less the next time you have to get on a plane. Once upon a time, airline travel was exciting and exotic. Boy, I can remember those days. Today, it's more of an endurance test. Unruly passenger incidents defined by the Federal Aviation Commission as passengers disrupting flights with threatening or violent behavior jumped to 56,000 in 2021, up 492% from a year earlier. Marry that with crowded planes, cramped seats, confusing rules on fees for bags and seat selection, inadequate staffing, outdated infrastructure, and high prices, and it's no wonder that flying is so trying. But there are ways to minimize the pain. Start by checking our airline ratings on page 47, which we'll look at. Based on our 2023 survey of 17,000 CR members and their experiences on nearly 33,000 flights, considering Hawaiian Airlines if it flies your route, economy class passengers gave top marks for check-in ease and on-time performance, as well as for cabin cleanliness and service. Budget carriers Spirit and Frontier got the lowest scores, especially when it came to price transparency and seat selection. JetBlue and Spirit are awaiting merger approval. Hawaiian and Alaskan Airlines each earned a thumbs up for business and first-class passengers. Read on for other tips to improve your next flight. Number one, it all starts with the flight you book. Check prices a few months in advance. For domestic trips, Zach Griff, senior reporter at the Points Guy travel website, recommends starting to monitor prices 3 to 4 months before your departure date. To begin your search, he recommends the Google Flights website. They have an awesome price history and prediction tool. It gives you the amount your route has cost over the last couple of months, has a price graph that predicts what prices will be nearly a year in advance, and tells you what Google thinks is a fair price today. It will also let you set up a price alert to get emails when prices change. However, it won't include prices on Southwest flights because that airline lists fares only on its own site. Remember that the fare prices you see don't include the extra fees you may pay to check bags, get a seat upgrade, and more. You can use tools like the Bags Filter and Google Flights to see the cost of your flight plus fees. Book a domestic flight on 1 or 2 months in advance. This is likely to get you the most choice of flying times and seat selection, Griff says. The idea that booking on a particular day of the week will guarantee the best price is a myth, says Eric Bowman, executive editor of the travel news site Travel Plus. Because computer algorithms monitor demand and change prices almost constantly. There's no real best time to book. Instead, try to lock in a deal when the alerts you've set let you know prices have dropped, or when your research tells you the price you're seeing is a good deal. Some airlines eliminated change and cancellation fees during COVID-19, so you may be able to get a credit if your airline dropped the fare price after you bought a ticket. Griff suggests you call your airline if it's been longer than 24 hours since you booked, and you get a price drop alert. The rules and exceptions of getting a credit can be complicated, but an agent can usually take care of it quickly over the phone. Fly early in the day or late at night. Always book the first flight of the day, says Brett Wells, an aviation journalist. Indeed, Department of Transportation data shows that the 30 largest U.S. airports, the most on-time departures typically are between 6 and 8 a.m., then tend to fall as the day goes on. If you're a red-eye fan, in many cases, the on-time departure rate improves between 11 p.m. and midnight as well. Find the best seats. If you book one of the cheapest fares, you might not be able to choose your seat, and Southwest does not assign seats. But if you have the option, note the type of plane, then consult websites such as SeatGuru or Aerolopa, that's A-E-R-O-L-O-P-A, for details about legroom and pitch, the distance from one seat to the next in the plane. SeatGuru also has information on whether seats recline or have a misaligned window. Then it's up to you to decide whether you want to pay more to sit in a particular seat. Get lower fees. If you want to check bags, pick a seat, board early, and get Wi-Fi aboard, you have to navigate the complex field of additional fees. Discounters Frontier and Spirit make the process especially complex, which is probably the reason they received the lowest scores in our ratings for price transparency. Your best bet is to become familiar with what an airline typically charges and what fees you can avoid. As to seat fees, a recent analysis in NerdWallet found that budget brands Frontier and Spirit changed the most seat selection, and Alaska and Hawaii the least. Airlines that charged less than $10 on average for a seat selection were Alaska, Hawaiian, JetBlue, and United Airlines. Airlines that charged $15 or more, Delta, American, Spirit, and Frontier. In addition to the info on bag fees you get from Google flight searches, you can also often find bag fees on an airline's website, though this may take several clicks. America and Delta charge $30 for one check bag, as does United if you check in advance, versus $35 at the airport. For a flight from New York to L.A., Spirit charges $65 for a check bag when you're booking on its site, $73 if you pay when you check in online, and $89 at the airport and $99 at the gate, though fees change depending on a specific flight. If you fly a lot on a particular airline, avoid fees by using its co-branded credit card or by qualifying for elite status. Bowman has the Delta SkyMiles card, so his first bag is free on Delta. Wilson flies Southwest when possible and has an A-list preferred status. The perks, early boarding, free Wi-Fi, and a dedicated phone line to a representative. Make connections without sweating it. A minimum connection time is the amount of transfer time considered sufficient for a passenger to make a connection between an arriving and a departing flight. These MCTs are baked into flight search results. Still, Griff advises to give yourself 2 hours between flights, especially around the holidays. Download the airline's app. You can use it to check in before you get to the airport, be alerted about delays, book another flight if yours is canceled, and track your bags, Wilson says. In addition, it will show you the connection gates and maybe a map to get you there. The new airplane etiquette. To avoid flaring tempers and tight quarters, a little common courtesy can go a long way. Don't start an armrest war. The protocol, says Diane Gottman, an etiquette expert and owner of the Protocol School of Texas, is that the person in the middle seat has access to both armrests because they're in the least comfortable seat. If they're not using them, ask whether you can use the one nearest you. Recline with care. Yes, the seat has a recline button. Your car has a steering wheel, but that doesn't mean you use it to run into other people, says Gottman. Before you use it as a button, look backward. Make sure it is not inconvenient someone who might be very tall or has a mobility issue or those whose tray is down. Don't recline if it's obvious you'd be inconveniencing someone and it's a short flight, she says. Plan ahead by avoiding restrictive clothing, she suggests, so even in tight quarters you'll be comfortable. Otherwise, be courteous and say, "Would you mind if I recline my seat?" Avoid smelly and potentially dangerous food. If you bring food like tuna fish on board, don't expect everyone to welcome you with open arms, says Gotsman. Steer clear of pungent foods as well as foods that commonly cause allergic reactions like tree nuts or peanuts. Keep sharing to a minimum. You can't be best friends with someone on a two-hour flight, says Gotsman. I sat next to someone recently who shared way too much about their kidney disease and asked a lot of personal questions, she says. To shut that down, say, you're going to have to excuse me. I'm going to put my earbuds in and nap. Keep your shoes on. Dress in a way that's respectful of other passengers, says Gotsman. If you would sleep in it at night, don't wear it on a plane, and wear your most comfortable with, but closed-in shoes. Stress less at the airport. Time your arrival right. For domestic flights, plan on arriving at least 90 minutes early, says Griff of the Points Guy. If it's a busy time at the airport midday, Thursday through Monday, or traveling during the holiday or summer season, 2 hours is safer. For international flights, arrive at least 2 hours before departure and 3 hours during busy times. Expedite the security process for a fee. If you're a frequent flyer, consider joining a program that cuts your time in security lines. TSA PreCheck gives you access to an expedited security line. Plus, there's no need to remove shoes, belts, light jackets, laptops, or 311 compliant liquids. It costs $78 for a 5-year membership. In June 2023, 88% of PreCheck passengers waited less than 5 minutes, according to its website. You must fly with an airline that participates in PreCheck. More than 85 do, and more than 200 airports across the country have dedicated PreCheck lanes. Clear Plus is an expedited airport security service that allows its members to verify their identity using biometrics without having to show a physical form or identification to a CSA agent. Once your identity has been verified at a Clear kiosk, you're escorted to the front of the security line. The sweet spot of zipping through airport security fast is when you use both of these services together. With a Clear membership, you can quickly verify your identity and then go to the front of the PreCheck line. A Clear member shops $189 annually. You can add up to 3 family members for $70 each per year. Though family members under age 18 can use the Clear lane without a membership when traveling with their parents. Clear is available only at about 50 domestic airports, but it can also be used at stadiums and arenas that require lining up for a security check. Several frequent flyer programs and some credit cards offer cardholders discounts on a Clear membership, including many co-branded airline cards and a Green American Express card. If you travel internationally, Global Entry includes PreCheck and provides expedited service to the U.S. Customs and Immigration. The fee is $100 for a 5-year membership. Make waiting worthwhile. If you have time to kill in the airport, plan ahead by downloading movies or shows to watch, or podcasts to listen to, or by bringing a book or e-reader, says journalist Wilson. If it's a long layover in a larger airport, there are pay lounges you can go to. I have indulged in these, especially during long flight delays, she says. Many airlines will allow you to buy a lounge day pass, and you can do it right on their app. For example, America's Admirals Club and United Club offers one-day passes at some of the locations for $59. Delta doesn't offer a one-day pass. If you travel frequently, you might want to consider a network that offers access to lounges. For example, Priority Pass provides access to more than 1,300 lounges across the world. The cost for Priority Pass, least expensive membership, is $69 per year, plus $35 each time you enter a lounge. Lounge Buddy doesn't change membership fee. Customers use its app to buy lounge passes at more than 300 lounges. Day passes cost $27 to $54 each, depending on the lounge. If you have a travel credit card with a hefty annual fee, it might provide lounge access. For example, Citi-AA Advantage Executive Credit Card includes access to the Admirals Club for you and 2 guests, and it's $595 annual fee. If you have Delta SkyMiles Reserve Credit Card from American Express, $550 per year, you can use Delta Sky Club, which gives you 2 free one-time guest passes. Also, visit your airport's websites to see whether there are any special amenities you might want to check out, says Griff. Charco, O'Hare's, and Midway International Airports, as well as Burlington, Dallas, Fort Worth, Miami, and San Francisco International Airports, have dedicated yoga rooms. Dine like the locals. Check the website of the airport you'll be visiting ahead of time to check out their dining options. Airports across the U.S. have been giving passengers upgraded food options, and a big part of that includes bringing popular local eateries to the terminals, Wilson says. Some of her faves, Leah's Kitchen and Louis Armstrong's New Orleans International Airport, for creations based on the late Leah Chase's Creole cuisine. Drifted Texas barbecue spot The Salt Lick has restaurants in the Austin and Dallas airports, and Chicago celebrity chef Rick Bayless, a Frontera grill firm, has Tortas Front locations at O'Hare, but you'll probably pay a premium. Andrew Wettig, executive director of the Airport Restaurant and Retail Association, says many airport restaurants charge 10% more than the local street price. The exception is BWI Airport in Baltimore, which charges street prices at all its restaurants, and learns the basics of baggage carry-ons. Your carry-on bag will need to fit the size regulation of your airline, which you can find on its site. Most airlines implement a maximum policy of 22 by 14 by 9 inches, including wheels and handles. Some airlines may charge for a carry-on bag if you fly its least expensive class. For example, JetBlue charges basic blue cover $65 for a carry-on bag. One personal item no longer than 17 by 13 by 8 inches is free. Budget airlines have stricter carry-on policies. Allegiant allows only one 18 by 14 by 8 inch personal item. Carry-on bag fees range from $10 to $75. Frontier also allows only one free personal item of the same size restriction, and carry-on bag fees from $57 to time of booking to $71 close to your travel date. Wilson has flown Spirit when the same route on Southwest is too pricey, or when Southwest doesn't fly her route. To avoid fees, I take one bag that I use only for Spirit. That's the width and length of a laptop, she says. And a final ghost story for this pre-Halloween. In one of my favorite ghost stories, a man thinks that he loses his phone, but someone is playing a trick on him. Turns out there is someone playing with him, but it's a ghoul rather than a person. Last night, a friend rushed me out of the house to catch an opening act of a local bar's music night. After a few drinks, I realized my phone was in my pocket. I checked the table we were sitting at, the bar, the bathrooms, and after no luck, I used my friend's phone to call mine. After two rings, someone answered, gave out a low, raspy giggle, and hung up. They didn't answer again. I eventually gave it up as a lost cause and headed home. I found my phone laying on my nightstand, right where I'd left it. And with that, we have just about run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.